Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Ian McCrudden, who is a filmmaker whose film is called Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer, which is screening here in Santa Fe. Right now, I would like to welcome Bill Burke-White. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our regular foreign correspondent. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So we are here to talk about something which is not very good news these days, which is the events happening in Israel and the occupied territories. You were in Jordan and Israel yourself a couple of weeks ago. What were you doing there?
I was in both Jordan and then in Jerusalem doing work on human rights and particularly freedom of expression training for the media in Jordan. And it was a very interesting opportunity to see where things are in the Middle East before the most unfortunate latest round of conflict that started just after I left.
So let's talk first about what is actually happening there. What is happening there and why?
So for in mid-December, a ceasefire that had been in place between Israel and the Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip expired. And thereafter, the Hamas militants in Gaza began launching rockets into Israel, and over a period of a few weeks, several hundred rockets were launched into Israel. Israel responded more than 10 days ago by beginning a much more aggressive military campaign, first through a number of days of simply using airstrikes and missiles fired into Gaza, and then last week began a ground campaign in Gaza. Over the past few days, the Israelis have essentially driven a wedge into Gaza, separating the northern and southern parts of Gaza. And for those who aren't familiar with the geography, Gaza is a 45-square-mile territory wedged between Israel, Egypt, and the Mediterranean Sea, and they, with about 1.5 million residents, so it's an extraordinarily densely populated territory, and Israeli ground troops entered and sort of drove across the center of Gaza, separating the northern and southern parts, and then on Monday moved north into Gaza City, going essentially building to building, securing Gaza City, and then yesterday began moving south to some of the areas in the south where rockets were being launched into Israel from Gaza. Most recently today, Israel had a three-hour halt to the fighting between 1 and 4 p.m. local time, which they described as intended to allow civilians to go to hospital if need be, to purchase food and supplies. And after that 4 p.m. Halt expired, began again its military campaign, and particularly an air campaign back in Gaza. The Israelis have said that they will every other day allow for such a pause in the fighting. And as of the most recent statistics released by the UN, it looks like about 650 Palestinians have been killed in the fighting so far. It's unclear how many of those were Hamas militants and how many of those were civilians. Reports suggest that somewhere between a quarter and half of the dead are in fact civilians. So that's kind of where it stands in the conflict as of today.
And so what is the Israeli government's rationale for doing this to these people who are living in a very small, as you say, 45-square-mile area?
So the Israeli government has said that their purpose and that their ultimate goal is to stop the rocket fire that has been coming out of Gaza and hitting civilian points within Israel. And they have said that they will only accept a solution that guarantees an end to those rocket attacks by the Hamas leadership. So that's Israel's objective. There's reason to think that Israel may, in fact, have a broader objective than that, which is essentially wiping out the Hamas militants in Gaza, or at least preventing them from being a force going forward. Israel has denied that regime change is part of their goal, but if you look at their actions to date, it seems hard to imagine that part of their goal is not to at least limit the power of Hamas going forward.
What is the nature of the firepower that each side has? What do they have? How do they use it? And where do they get it?
So let's start with Hamas, which is the supposedly democratically elected government in Gaza. It is essentially a militant force that doesn't have significant military capacity. Some could be describe them as sort of terrorists in the sense of that they have limited means of force at their disposal, but they use it to threaten civilians and target civilians, largely because that's the most effective way for them to make a difference with the military capacity they have. They have, for example, AK-47 rifles, grenades, shoulder-launched rockets that can be fired into Israel, and most of those weapons have been smuggled across the border from Egypt through a series of tunnels that connect Egypt and Gaza, provided by various both perhaps quasi-governmental and other networks in the Middle East. Israel, in contrast, has a very highly developed modern military. At least in terms of the kind of warfare that you need to fight in a small territory like this, have commanding air power, much more effective satellite imagery and, you know, drones flying overhead, and are every bit a modern, effective military, probably, in fact, more effective at the kind of street-to-street fighting that we're now seeing in Gaza than the United States military was when it entered Baghdad back in 2003. Most of Israel's military capacity comes from U.S. suppliers, legally purchased by Israel and sold by the United States and U.S. contractors. They also have some military equipment sold by Europeans and others, but it's primarily a U.S. Supplied military, and that in part explains its radical technological advantages over the kind of Hamas militants who really have simply rifles and shoulder-launched rockets.
How do you understand the timing of this? I mean, we are in at least in the United States, transitional phase between one government and another. Is there a relationship between that and what's happening in Israel right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple of ways to think about Israel's timing here. There's a few critical events to be aware of. The first was a ceasefire agreement that had existed between Israel and Hamas that expired in December. And initially there was hope that ceasefire would be renewed, as it has been occasionally in the past. And Hamas appeared to be willing to at least discuss with Israel the possibility of a renewal of that ceasefire. So that gave a kind of opening for a renewed military conflict. And if one was sitting in Tel Aviv thinking about whether to use this moment to begin a broader campaign against Hamas, there's a number of reasons why now makes sense for Israel. The first is, as you mentioned, that on January 20th, President Obama will take office, and it is unclear at this point what President Obama's stance will be in the Middle East, and what his view of a military campaign by Israel would be. from Israel's perspective, at the moment, they are well assured that the Bush administration will continue to be, at best, indifferent to and perhaps even supportive of an Israeli military campaign. The Bush administration has essentially come out and said that Israel is a sovereign, independent state, and it's not our business whether they engage in military conflict with Hamas, and that Hamas is a terrorist organization, and therefore Israel might well be justified in doing so. That kind of a statement is very much a support for Israel and gave Israel a kind of permission to proceed. And I think the Israelis are very concerned that an Obama administration might be less favorable if he were to come out, for example, and demand an end to the conflict. It would be very difficult for Israel to ignore that. So this was a moment of opportunity when Israel still knew it would have strong U.S. support. The other aspect of the timing, I think, is that there is a strong likelihood that under a new Obama administration, there will be renewed diplomatic efforts led by Richard Haass, who is likely to be appointed the new special envoy under Obama for the Israel-Palestine conflict to find some sort of peace settlement. And often what you will see in military conflict is that in the days and weeks before a new peace process begins, both sides seek to improve their military position, because the stronger the position is that you're in when peace talks start, the better the ultimate settlement is likely to be for you. And so if Israel thinks that there is likely to be a new peace process beginning, they would much rather be in a strong military position at that point, and Hamas to be weakened considerably before such a peace process. And so I think part of the timing is also this kind of pre-peace process move that we often see. We saw it in World War I. We saw it in World War II to some degree. We certainly saw it in the war in the Balkans in the 1990s. And so this is not atypical for parties who think that a peace process is about to start to actually expand fighting before that peace process begins.
From the point of view of a chess player, that kind of makes sense. From the point of view of a human being who is witnessing, even if from afar, the unbelievable suffering there, it sounds horrifyingly cynical.
I think you're right to say that it is cynical. It's certainly not a strategy that puts the short-term well-being of the civilian population as a first priority. From Israel's perspective, their view is the goal is a peace settlement that protects Israel's sovereignty and guarantees its security over the longer term. And so I think they justify their actions based on that longer-term goal and the need to stop the rocket attacks. But certainly if you're sitting in Gaza as a Palestinian civilian, that logic is horrifically cynical and one that doesn't put civilian well-being first. The way Israel has gone about this campaign has been to attempt to minimize civilian casualties, and they have certainly warned civilians that the attacks would take place in certain areas, but there is really no way to engage in a street-to-street campaign like we're seeing in Gaza City now without seriously jeopardizing civilian life, and it's not therefore surprising that we've seen as many civilian casualties as we have in this kind of hand-to-hand, street-by-street fighting.
Let's talk about the Palestinian government. There are different factions there that are not one with each other, shall we say.
Yeah, there are essentially two different governments in Palestine. You have the Palestinian Authority, led by Mohammed Abbas, that controls the West Bank. And again, for those who don't have the geography in their minds, the West Bank is the territory on the south side of Israel. It's known as the West Bank because it's on the western side of the Jordan River, that used to be part of Jordan, and that Jordan lost control of when during the Jordanian-Israeli war, that territory is run by the Palestinian Authority and is, in fact, relatively well-governed. Abbas has made great strides to provide some economic options there and to really calm down the level of strife there. And interestingly, and we'll turn back to this in a moment, the West Bank has not really joined in the current conflict in Gaza. In contrast to the Palestinian Authority and Abbas, in Gaza, the government is run by Hamas. Hamas is, depending on your perspective, a political party or a terrorist organization. It was elected by the Gazan people, so it is an elected government, but it is one that is extraordinarily militant, very much anti-Israeli, but also one that is trying to govern a 45-square-mile territory with no entry and exit points to the rest of the world and no economic opportunity with 1.5 million people. There is an internal conflict between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. Both of those organizations would like to be the voice of the Palestinian people, and there is, in a sense, a proxy war going on whereby Abbas and the Palestinian Authority have been, I don't want to say supportive of Israel's actions, but have not joined against Israel and joined Hamas, in part because the Palestinian Authority would be very happy to see Hamas's power diminished. And if you look at what's been going on in the West Bank in the past few days, Palestinian Authority forces have actually blocked and stopped possible rallies that were going to be started in support of Hamas. They have banned the use of Hamas flags and other symbols and have very much tried to limit Hamas's power. And so, in a sense, Abbas and the Palestinian Authority are certainly not completely on the sidelines, but I think very happy to see Gaza Hamas militants limited in their political influence such that the Palestinian Authority will have more power and influence going forward. So you certainly have a division among the leadership. You also have, I think, to some degree, a lack of the expected support for Hamas that we might have seen from civilians and ordinary Palestinians living in the West Bank. There have been a few small demonstrations in support of the Hamas activities, but it's pretty clear that many of the civilians in the West Bank have been become war-weary and would very much like to see the ceasefire and peace that had existed for the last few years back in place, and so have not started a broader uprising against Israel like we've seen during some conflicts in the past.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White, our foreign correspondent. It does really call into question what it means to have a democratically elected government and whether that government is legitimate. I mean, you could say a lot of really bad things and be accurate about the United States government, and you might have a whole lot of people in the United States who are not in support of what the U.S. is doing, and you might even question whether it's a legitimately, at this point, an elected government at all. But it's still recognized as such, and that seems not to be the case for Hamas. Is that just because they don't have the military power that a larger country has?
So, yeah, you raise a very important point with respect to what role democracy ought to play in our thinking about governments. For better or worse, for the last 10 or even 15 years under the Bush administration and even Clinton before that, getting governments to be democracies and pushing toward democratic rule was to some degree the end-all and be-all of U.S. foreign policy. But what we have come to see is that democratic governments certainly do not necessarily mean U.S.-friendly governments, and Hamas is the obvious example of that, but also don't mean good governments. It's quite easy for a government that is not, in fact, respective of its people, that doesn't put its people's interests first, to be democratically elected through even semi-legitimate elections. And so for a government like Hamas, it is true that it is democratically elected, but it is a government that probably has not not put the well-being of the Palestinian people as the forefront of its policy goals. What that means, I think, from the U.S. and Israeli perspective, is a very difficult set of choices as to how you treat such a government. On one hand, it has been elected and is the voice of that people. On the other hand, you probably disagree with many of its policies. And Israel's approach, and to some degree the U.S. approach in Iraq, though the circumstances were somewhat different, has been to try to promote regime change to get a different and perhaps better government in power. And I think that's part of why Israel, even if they're not saying it, is in fact trying to change the government in the Palestinian territories. The Hamas government has very few levers of power. They have essentially no economy to speak of. They have very little political support in the United States or at the United Nations. And so the only tools of leverage they have available is the kind of militancy that we're seeing at the moment. So it's far from clear how we should deal with such a government. Our approach in the United States has essentially been to recognize and fully support and even fund the Palestinian Authority government run by Abbas based in the West Bank, and to think of Hamas as a terrorist organization rather than a legitimate government.
It does. I mean, not to dwell on this point, because there's a lot more to talk about, but if we want to talk about governments that have militant tendencies and don't put the interests of their people first, we could talk very easily about the Bush administration. And if we are applying the same standards to everyone else as we are applying in Israel-Palestine, that means that any other large government would have the right and duty to try to apply regime change to us.
Well, there is a very specific set of legal distinctions that I'll draw briefly and then raise the broader question that you have, which is that unlike, for example, when the United States went to Iraq and said we were going to change the regime there, Israel is the legally occupying power under the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949 of Gaza and the West Bank. And that means that Israel actually has international legal responsibility for protecting the civilians and improving the situation in Gaza. Gaza is still, in fact, part of Israel. And so it's not to say that Israel is right to engage in a particular kind of military attack, but that Israel does have a legal responsibility to promote the best interests of the Gazan citizens. How do you define that best interest? Well, one way is to say they had a popular election and this is the government they've chosen. Israel certainly has much more at stake and a far stronger legal argument to say that they have a right to engage in a military campaign in Gaza than we did, or than for any other country saying we don't like the U.S. government, we'll try to engage in regime change. The moral question is a harder one. Certainly, to simply say we don't like your government, we're going to change it, is a very perilous moral position. But then again, you have to remember from the Israeli perspective, they are under relatively constant bombardment by rockets launched from Gaza hitting civilians in Israel. So the moral case from the Israeli perspective, I think, is far stronger than it is for most any other country to intervene on grounds of regime change.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. What is the European position on this conflict? Are they a support? I think they're not as supportive as the Bush administration has been of Israel.
The international diplomatic effort has essentially been led by the Europeans. The United States position, as I said before, has been to say it's a matter of Israel's sovereignty and we're not going to intervene. The Europeans, led largely by French President Nicolas Sarkozy, have been quite active in diplomatic negotiations in Israel, talking with both sides there, trying to get a ceasefire back in place. Tony Blair, who is the former British Prime Minister and now the representative of the quartet countries dealing with the conflict, has also been very active, but taken a probably more balanced position. There's also active negotiations going on at the United Nations. Libya has brought forward a resolution on Wednesday calling for a permanent ceasefire. The Egyptians have also brought forward a proposal calling for a ceasefire. There have not yet been votes on those bills, in large part because the United States has sought to postpone any vote on a ceasefire resolution. Mohammed Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, is at the United Nations taking part in those negotiations. And I think that ultimately over the coming week or two, we will see a new ceasefire put in place. The question really will be how long that takes. And part of that, I think, turns on whether the United States and some of the European countries want to give Israel a longer time and more space to try to limit Hamas's power going forward. And at this point, it looks like it will be at least a few more days before there is a formal call from the United Nations for a ceasefire through a binding resolution.
It does seem like kind of the ultimate irony, if I may say so, that the United States says we're not going to intervene, this is a matter of Israeli sovereignty, when they are providing the military, financial, and political wherewithal for a conflict like this to happen in the first place.
Yeah, it's a difficult question for the United States. In part, as you say, much of the military equipment being used by Israel is of United States origin, and we provide more foreign aid to Israel and Egypt than to any other two countries in the world. So one can make the argument, as you just noted, that the United States is really supplying and allowing the conflict to continue. At the same time, when we choose to sell weapons to foreign countries, those countries can do with them as they like. And that's one of the dangers of selling arms overseas. And one of the consequences of that is we have perhaps less control of it than we would like. And something for us to think about in our foreign policy going forward is whether we really ought to be selling military equipment. But once you sell it, you lose operational control of it. But it is true that it is hard to separate the United States from some level of guilt or responsibility, I suppose, depending on your perspective, with respect to the use of that equipment by Israel in this conflict.
One of the things that I think is so difficult about this conflict, which seems intractable and it seems so, I mean, it's multi-generational, is that both sides feel very strongly and very emotionally that they are the underdog. So there is, you hear people saying, poor little Israel sitting in the middle of hostile territory, and they're very close to all of these countries whose people don't like them very much, or many of whose people don't like them very much. And then here are the Palestinians living with no economy and really overtly oppressed in many ways by Israel. And it seems that very few people who are involved in the conflict seem to be able to hold both sides of the narrative in their mind.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. There is no conflict in the world that people take as personally or feel as much sort of personal kinship to one side or the other than this particular conflict. If you ask people to think about the conflict between, say, India and Pakistan, they usually can make rational arguments on both sides. And with this conflict, it strikes people very close to home and to core belief sets and values. At the end of the day, however, I think both sides really are guilty in different ways here. On one hand, Israel is, as you put it, poor little Israel, but it is stuck between a series of countries that do not recognize it or that have expressly demanded that Israel cease to exist. If you're sitting in Amman, Jordan, you're 45 minutes from Tel Aviv, from Jerusalem, an hour and a half from Tel Aviv. And Saudi Arabia is not far, Iran is not far, Iraq is very close. So Israel does have a legitimate fear and has been being attacked by rockets from Gaza. At the same time, Israel is responsible for occupying a territory of 45 square kilometers with 1.5 million people in it. So the Israelis can, on one hand, are oppressed in geopolitical terms, but on the other hand are the oppressors. And if you look at the Palestinian side, Yes, they're civilians living essentially within a large fence with very few opportunities for them, but they've also elected a government committed to a military conflict against Israel and allowed that government to do so. And so if one can step back from sort of personal values and beliefs, I think it's pretty easy to see that both sides bear responsibility here. And I think the only way you can move toward a solution, which will hopefully happen after the new president takes office in the United States and elections in Israel next month, is to move beyond questions of fault and guilt, because both sides really do bear responsibility here.
I can't help but visualize, and maybe this is just a ridiculously pie-in-the-sky hope, of this area of the world eventually being like Europe, where you have a bunch of countries very close together, each with their own incredibly rich cultures, and living side by side in relative peace. Is that even thinkable?
Well, I think it would be overly optimistic to expect that kind of a result in the next few years. But in the longer term, that I think is the ultimate goal, a two-state solution, but one that allows people to move about between them and to bring together different cultures and religions. I guess the best analogy or hope that I could give for the future that you just outlined is to think back to Europe. If you went to 1943, for example, it would be fairly hard to imagine that France and Germany would essentially be run by a common government in Brussels, and that within 3 hours, without showing a passport, you could pass from Paris to Frankfurt. And the transformation of Europe in the last 45 years perhaps offers an analogy for the kind of transformation we could hope to see in the Middle East, but it took Europe 45 years. It could take that long or longer to see such a result in the Middle East, but I think that would be clearly the ideal goal over the longer term.
Bill Burke-White is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our foreign correspondent with us about once a month. Happy New Year to you, Bill, and thanks so much for being with us once again on KSFR.
Happy New Year to you as well, and it's always a pleasure. Have a good morning.
Thank you. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the film Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer. Let's hear some music right now by Anita O'Day.
Because my man has gone, so from now on, I'm a traveling light. He said goodbye and took my heart. From today, I'm traveling light. No one to see.
And I'd like now to welcome Ian McCrudden. He is a filmmaker. He co-wrote, directed, edited, and produced the film Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer, which is screening at the Screen at the College of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Now, Anita O'Day, an incredible jazz singer in the same class with Billie Holiday, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald. Where did she come from? What kind of milieu produced this amazing artist?
Well, we recount her biographical history in the movie, but in short, she was born in Chicago to a kind of mismatched set of parents, and her father was a gambler and a drinker, and so the story goes, he bet a horse called Anita one time, and it won, and then named his daughter after the horse. But she was a truant in junior high and started doing walkathons, which they made a movie about with Jane Fonda called they they don't shoot horses, do they? And it, basically, you walked for days, and whoever walked the longest won the contest, and you got some money. And so that's where she started, and eventually she started kind of chirping and singing along, too, hoping always to be a singer. And she was working as a waitress in a club when she was discovered by Gene Krupa, and he heard her sing, and he said, if I ever lose my girl singer, I'm going to let you audition. And he did lose his girl singer, and he came back and gave her an audition and gave her a job. So that's kind of how she kicked off as a professional singer. And then as we kind of tell the story in the movie, it's sort of like that would have given her one life and career, you know, to be a canary singing with big bands, singing charts and the melodies that they give you. But instead, this sort of truant, naughty person struck out on her own musically and creatively, and became this fantastic singer and sort of really charted her own course through, I would say, 50 years of being a vital performer.
She
died at 87, and we were with her for the last 10 years of her life. I knew her personally, and we collected film from her whole life and then shot interviews and spent time with her in the last 7. So it was a pretty full, rich life that she lived.
Indeed. Was she completely self-taught?
As she explains it, she was. And she, she tells us in the movie that she had certain limitations that other singers did not. For example, her uvula had been cut off in a tonsillectomy when she was young. So when she realized that she was limited in terms of like holding notes, and that she had an admirable tone nonetheless, it was still not a perfect tone, she began to figure out other ways to sing the songs. And that's where she first started trying to like fill in the notes between the notes that were on the chart for the melody. And that's sort of how her jazz singing began. So it was definitely a process of discovery that was unique to how she came to sing and learn how to sing, which to me is fascinating about great artists, is that on some level they're untrained and they sort of trust some unique difference or special quality or handicap or whatever it is and go with it, you know?
Very much so. I mean, it seems that somebody in the film commented that she never imitated anybody, but a whole lot of people imitated her. It seems like she was going on pure intuition and creativity.
Yeah. Instinct was definitely a big part of what she did. And I think it might have been Russell Garcia, who was like a major dude composer, composed records for Verve. And he said that. And another thing he said about her, which I felt was true, was that it was sort of like she had to be an actor in order to be able to do this. She had to have the same quality as an actor to be able to sing the songs and sell them and be in the moment so immediately with them, and to tell the story of the song at the same time. And having worked in narrative film too, I would say that was true about her. And also she had a very athletic quality, meaning she was, you know, she was on when she was on, and when she wasn't, it was like she wasn't even there at all. You know, it was like, let's go play horses or do whatever, you know. It wasn't like
right. She
was sitting around thinking about music all the time. It just happened for her when she did it.
One of the things that was so interesting in the movie was that she really broke some gender barriers and gender role ideas. So the woman singer fronting a band, until Anita O'Day wore a ball gown, and she decided to wear a suit jacket and a skirt and loose, comfortable clothing, and she really set a trend.
Yeah, I mean, it's another way in which she's just so cool, I have to say. You know, I'm like a huge fan of hers. It's no mistake if you watch the movie. But yeah, I mean, it's just another thing that she realized, like, I'm on the road with a bunch of guys all the time. I'm the one girl, and I like to play poker on the bus, and I like to smoke and drink. So why can't I dress like the rest of them? Do I have to wear this ridiculous costume? And so she just said, make me a suit. And Krupa, to his credit, said, cool, you know. And I should say also that she broke some race barriers, too, because
right.
singing on stage with Roy Elridge in the Let Me Off Uptown was a real first, too, to see a great black artist with a white singer together on stage and then later on TV and you know, Soundies, the films they made. That was inspiring to a lot of black artists, too. And I think that a lot of people felt like that world didn't really have the racial lines within it, but race was still perceived in the way outside, and for people to step across those lines was cool.
Right.
And bold.
She was really, I mean, to sum it up in a certain way, she was a really free spirit. And one of the things that the movie made me think about was the kind of freedom that she had in her life, in the way she lived, in the way she dressed, in the way she performed, really informed her music and made it possible. I mean, it's almost like to be a jazz singer of that caliber and that musicianship, you have to be that free inside.
I think that's true, and I think that there were some prices that she paid for that freedom, and I think that that's sort of the flip side of her story. But and it was a fascinating thing to me knowing her. You know, in the end of her life, she had no family, she had no children, she didn't have any husbands. She had married a couple of times during her life, but her primary long-term relationship was that with her drummer, who also was the first person to turn her on to heroin,
right.
which was the other sort of long-term relationship she had in her life. And those relationships allowed for the kind of freedom that you're talking about. More than anything else or any other relationships, those long-term relationships in her life were defined by her desire to be free and beholden to nothing else. And I think it's Margaret Whiting actually says in the movie that she said that when she took drugs, she was free. And she uses the same word you're using. And I think that, you know, to just stand up in front of people without a map and trust that between your drummer who's going to drive your rhythm and where you're going in your mind, you're going to get to some place that's going to be entertaining. I mean, that's a pretty bold performance. That's not a lot of people can do that.
That's right. And she did it before, during, and after her 15-year-long heroin addiction. I mean, it was really striking that the drugs that she used, especially heroin, seemed to be very effective. And in the section of the movie where you talk about heroin, you see her performing in a way that, you know, the movie implies is enhanced by the use of that drug. And I have to say, it's terrifying,
don't
but she really, she's really good.
Well, you know, we tried not to make any huge judgments about her drug use other than the one she made herself, which is to say, it doesn't really affect whether you can do the thing at all. It just sort of allowed her to break through to be able to do it. And so I think her understanding of that ultimately is why she kicked. And the other part of this person's story that to me is so tremendous is that she did kick that addiction and she continued to live where so many other greats did not. You know, Miles and Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday, I mean, they all died tragically. Well, I think so. Tragically for us, but, you know, basically because of their lifestyles. And she somehow figured out how to live through all of that. And that, you know, that story in itself is worth telling.
Very
but then
much so.
To realize that the artist behind that is, you know, but there's something I said to my wife, for example, is that I'd never personally known or been around a person in my life whose art I so admired and what she did so admired and whose life I would never trade for.
Right. Interesting.
And it's something that's very interesting to have contemplated on in a real way. And I think it comes out in the movie and you kind of go, wow. And she was totally unapologetic for the life she lived. And that's how we should all feel at the end, I hope. But she truly felt that way. So
I'd like to talk about the
rules and was happy at the end.
Right.
Honestly.
Now, yeah, clearly. You come to, over the course of the film, you come to love not only her music, but her, because her spirit is steady and just so alive till the end of her life. I'd like to talk about the filmmaking. It's a really interesting and very, if I may say so, very musical example of filmmaking. The editing is done in a manner that shows a very deep understanding of her music. And there's no voiceover. All the commentary in it is by people in the business and people who knew her. Talk more about some of the choices that you made.
I should say, you know,
right.
I should make it clear that I made the movie with Robbie Cavallina, who was Anita's manager for the last 12 years of her life. So obviously that he provided a great deal of the history and sense of perspective, career-wise and everything, to bounce off. But then what I think really brought to it was to figure out a way to take all of this footage that we found and hours of musical performance and interview footage from 60 Minutes to Dick Cavett, all of these things and interviews she'd done on CBS 60 Minutes, CBS This Morning, plus all the footage that we ourselves shot because we started filming her in 2002. When she started to make her last record. So it was to figure out how to assemble all of this into a way that was going to tell her story and reveal her character, you know, reveal her person that she was without making it, I guess the key word is reveal it. And the reason I think the movie really works is because not a lot of people may really know who she is or was, or they may have heard of her, but they certainly didn't know enough about her that when they watch it, they have this real sense of discovery. And that's the experience that I had meeting her, coming to know her throughout this time, appreciating the music. So I think and loving the music is a big part of why you would even want to do something like this in the first place. And my background as a filmmaker was as an editor. So I knew that getting into the project is, you know, and we have a writing credit on this movie, but this is really something that we jumped into without a script. You know, I knew that Robbie and she were making an album, and I said to him, this is the time. We got to get this, and we can build the documentary around this. And so we started with very small money to begin, and, you know, it's been a seven-year endeavor, and now the movie's been in I don't know. I think by the end of February, it'll be in 100 cities across the country, and we won a satellite award for which is a Critics' Prize. And so it's been a long haul, but I don't know. I think.
Yeah, it's
discovering her.
It's a terrific
in,
movie.
In a
and
way
it's
that I think is well, it's a tribute ultimately, but it's also it's a portrait of the artist. It's not a telling of the salacious details of her life or anything like that. It's like come to know the artist and her work, and I think that that's really fascinating to people to really get that experience.
Very much so. How do you see Anita O'Day's legacy?
Hopefully helped a little bit by this movie, but I think honestly there's going to be a continued interest in her music. And that she will be the kind of person that people who listen to jazz singers will always know and always refer to. But hopefully the word will get a little outside of that so that people who may not listen to jazz music but like Beckett, for example, might tap into her as well. Because from where I came from, I was into jazz. That was cool. You know, I was just a guy in college, you know. But you know, I wasn't a jazz aficionado, and I wasn't a player of jazz. So, musically, I was just an appreciator. And you know, the artistry sort of it transcends, you know, liking or disliking the music. But I hope that the music carries her, you know, her life to other people because there's a lot to learn from the way she lived.
Ian McCrudden is a filmmaker, and his film is called Anita O'Day, The Life of a Jazz Singer. It is screening here in Santa Fe at the screen on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. For more information and showtimes, 473-6494. Ian, thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
It's been fun.
We're going to go out with my great pleasure. We're going to go out with some more music by Anita O'Day.
Thank you very kindly. It's wonderful being here in Japan and doing a television show for everyone here. I'd like to do a jazz interpretation of a song entitled Four Brothers. Four brothers? One. One, two, three, four.
And music of Anita O'Day. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message by phone at 505-428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features John's picks for the best jazz CDs of 2008. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.